I mean, you can read, you should be reading Romans. But, you know, just to, like, dive in and start the different kind of language, the different kind of rhetorical style, the theme. I mean, you will get excited. I mean, you'll get riled up, both positive and negatively, about, you know, that one, after Paul's introduction, and you get 1:18 to the beginning of chapter 2, I guarantee you it will get you thinking about, oh my goodness, what does this mean, and how do I, you know, figure this all out. So, but I do encourage you to read the text. There's nothing like it. And as I said last week, remember, you know, I've read Romans several times, and you know, I've sort of studied it over the years, and so I've come to feel like I have got a John Lentz interpretive structure to put on it. But I don't want to impose that on you. And so the things that I say, I believe, I mean, I feel that they make sense, but I'm not asking you to say, oh, whatever John said. I mean, I want you to engage with the text. That's what makes Bible study fun. It's not just what the preacher teacher says. It's like, you know, what is that preacher teacher calling me? How am I going to engage with the text? So I want to make sure that you remember that. Did anybody start reading Romans this week? All right, good. What's your thinking? What's your reaction to it?
It's just what you said in the sermon.
Just what I said in my sermon. I like that. After I just said, don't listen to the preacher.
No wonder he's in the front row.
Love you. Extra credit for this man.
Check.
Okay, other than just what the preacher said, no, thanks. What you know, what was your impression as you got into Romans a little bit? I'm sort of talking gut. Don't get so intellectual. Not necessarily what questions it raised, but how did it feel like you're opening this?
Pretty confusing.
Fair enough. Okay.
It's really dense.
Might want to come back to that. Really dense. Good. What else? Please.
He jumps right in. He sounds very condemning. Very preachy.
Yeah. He jumps right in. And the word would say he sounds very condemning. He gets very preachy. Okay, fair enough. Chapters 1 and 2. He's trying to set up a structure and a point that he's making by being rather condemning. But you're right. It's very much there. I saw their hands. Please, Anne.
Well, okay, as a person who studied a lot of Latin,
yeah,
and therefore a lot about ancient Rome, I have a lot of questions about social context.
Wonderful. And well, let's try to bring those up.
You know, not that I know that there's social context that frames a lot of this, but bringing the background I bring, I look at it and I go, well, just exactly what was going on in Rome?
Beautiful.
That caused him to write this.
Wonderful. We're going to try to touch upon that, and please, from your experience and other people, help me fill that out. Okay. Wonderful.
I know that Tom Snitch mentioned this last week, but I borrowed his copy, and that's what I read instead of Romans, and it fills in all that stuff. It's amazing. It's the Paul among his people.
Okay.
And it's dense, too.
Don't misunderstand me. That is an important book. I want you to read it. Read Romans first. Shame on you. Love you. You know what I mean. But don't, please, don't give me off. Don't let commentators tell you what Romans means. I would rather have you come.
It's not like that, though. It's about what
the
world
means. I know, but still, even that, I'd rather have you like engage first with what's confusing, what's overwhelming, what's condemning, and then, yes, backfill it with, okay, this is social context, this is historical context. But anyway, but that is a wonderful book, and we got to read it. Yes?
I think it's interesting, too, for me at least, bits and pieces, passages that I've heard preached on, you know, all my life. But when you look at the whole context, you know, rather than just these two or three verses, when you look at Bernese, as we call it,
Bernese,
in Bible and Bagels, it sometimes means something entirely different.
It does.
So it's important. I think it's really important for us to be getting the whole thing.
I think that's right. As I think I mentioned last week, to some extent, preaching is both vitally important, and I don't backtrack on that, but it's an artificial way of reading the text, meaning we read 6 or 8 verses or maybe 20 verses, and then somehow we rip that apart and it's fine and we think we've got a sermon here. Where, as Elspeth, you point out, and it's interesting, Betty, because your comment about sort of that first couple of chapters, it is condemning. He gets right to it. Gentiles do all this, ugh! And in the beginning of part two, he's like, and Jews, don't you think you get off? And I was like, whoa! But that is part of a whole kind of narrative scope that he's trying to do, both theologically and historical. And so that's why you want to read the whole thing, because you know, I think at the end of the day, Romans is really about grace. Really about the wideness of God's mercy. He's just trying to set you up. Right? I think it was, Tom, did you use this language? If not, it sounds kind of like you, but it's smart and good. But it's kind of like rhetorically setting you up for like, you know, soften you up and then boom. Which is a way of talking, I think, about that. Consuelo, yes.
Well, I was just saying that, I started reading it with my own perspective. It's like, what, given the social context that I have right now, and I keep thinking, you know, so what is he saying about what's going on right now?
Yeah.
Which sometimes it's not good. I have to keep reminding myself that he is, you know, writing a letter to Gentiles,
yeah,
with this Jew background, and I have to keep reminding myself because I keep thinking, so what does this mean in the social context?
Beautiful, but I don't belittle that engagement with the present, how the text speaks to our present age. You're right. We've got to be grounded in what was its original context, and that's where I think like Paul among the peoples is so important, because we're not going to really try to unpack this in 30 minutes today. I'll let you do it in your classes. But when you look at chapter 118 to the end of chapter 2, or the end of the chapter, you know, that, as we said before, that is one of like the proof texts for Christians who believe that homosexuality is sin. You know, that's one of their proof texts. Now, those of us of more of I don't know what we call it. Christians who believe in the full, we're more shaped by Pentecost than by, you know, where the gifts have been poured about on everybody, and so we want to celebrate all those. You know, our tendency, and I think it's proper, is to see that more in its first century context and to ask the question, was Paul even talking about what we understand in the 21st century by a loving, committed relationship, you know? And so you've got to be grounded in, the historical social context of the first century. But always, the reason it's Bible and it's our community living word, so we have to engage with it. How does Paul then speak to this world? And I always think one of the great examples of that, and you hear me say it again and again and again, but it's one of my proof texts, is in Jesus Christ there's no Jew or Greek, male or female, slave or free. In the way
it's also Pauline.
Oh, yeah, that is so, yeah, that's not John, that's Paul. That is so Pauline. And so therefore, you know, if that's what Paul's trying to say to the first century world, like all the barriers are broken down, sort of what I'm preaching on today. But, you know, if that's what Paul's saying, doesn't that make us think in this 21st century, where are those artificial boundaries, or even those boundaries that we think are God boundaries? I mean, doesn't Paul at least challenge us to rethink that? I saw Peter and then Tom. Peter, forget you. Tom.
You know, it's interesting, when I find this, and I have to watch when reading Paul, I concentrate on Paul. And Paul's saying, you know, concentrate on Jesus. This is his gospel about Jesus.
Right.
Sent by God, crucified, rose from the dead, love, salvation. And it's that focus as a Christian community on, to me at least, it forces me to focus on who is Jesus, what is Jesus. What does that mean?
Good. Yeah. Now, what is Paul trying to say about his deepest conviction that Jesus Christ turns everything on its head? You know, that opens, well, that's more of my metaphor, but certainly cracks open the door to a new way of perceiving what God is doing throughout history. And by new way, I want to be sure, I really want to be careful that I don't think the new way means that the Jewish way is wrong. because I don't think that's Paul either. But I do think for Gentiles, for non-Jews, it is a new way, because now we get to see, oh, you know, the door has been opened wide for us. Okay, Peter, please.
You have it right there, eschatology.
Right.
I mean, he's trying to draw together Gentiles and Jews into a common theme of the end times are upon us, the fulfillment of prophecies are upon us.
Beautiful.
We are about to see those times together.
Yeah, and we trust that God is doing something grand in this transition. Okay, you guys are so profound. This is wonderful. Let me go through my outline. No, but you know, always jump in because that's what makes it fun. And really, my first thing on my agenda was to ask, what's your gut in reading and what are some questions? And we got one wonderful question about a couple questions around the social context. Just looking at time, let me start a little bit and then come back out. So I was stopped in the hallway after class last Sunday and someone asked me the question having to do with sort of the placement of this letter. Was Paul in prison? You know, what was Paul doing? And so this gets into a little bit of the purpose behind why did Paul write. Paul was not in prison writing the letter to the Romans. If you read the letter to the Romans and you look at the book of Acts and the particular verses about Paul's movement, we can, with some degree of certainty, place this letter in the late 50s. Paul has finished missionary journeys. He writes about taking a collection back to the Jerusalem church. And so he's going through all over. And the collection is very interesting. Part of it seems to be just straight benevolence for the sisters and brothers in the Jerusalem church who need support, and it may be the wealth of the Greco-Roman Empire being directed a little bit to those folks who may not be as socially higher level, and so there's just benevolence, giftedness, but there also seems to be very much a underlying theme that Paul is trying to show the church in Jerusalem that he's okay. The home office is a little bit concerned about their top salesperson who's out in the hinterlands doing amazing things, but wow, boy, is he being creative. And so to some extent, Paul's missionary journey and coming back with the gift is to also say, I'm with you, home church. We're not on opposite sides. We know from reading Galatians and reading a little bit in Acts that Peter and Paul were not necessarily bosom buddies. And in fact, in Galatians 2 or 3, you know, Paul says, "And I spoke up and I said to Peter, you're wrong, you're a hypocrite." You know? And so there's real strife. And I think in the first century, you've got, you know, Paul going out and having this experience of God working in these wonderful ways. And he wants to come back and report to Jerusalem. He also wants to show that his churches are part of the Jerusalem church kind of foundation. So there is a kind of a unity. Okay, I'm on your side, Jerusalem church, bringing some money back, and I'm going to report of all the wonderful things that I've been doing. The sad irony of all this is that Paul does come back, right? Paul does come back to Jerusalem. Apparently, he offers the gift. And if you read Acts with any kind of sensitivity, you know, he goes up to the temple, he gets arrested, and then all of a sudden, he goes back there. You know, the other thing about the Romans letter, he says, you know, I desperately want to come see you, and I'll do that on my way back. You know, I'm going to Spain. Well, the irony, historical irony, and the biblical irony of all this is that Paul does make it to Rome, but then he is in shackles. He is going to be, he's going to end his life. Tradition has it that he ends his life in Rome. So this irony, he does is takes up this collection, he's bringing in reports. He's going to come back to the Jerusalem church, give the gift, give the report. He's hoping that they're going to have his back. And apparently, in fact, they don't have his back. Because you don't hear anything about any of the leaders of the Jerusalem church being at any Pauline trials. They just go, you know, they just sort of let him go. It opens up just an interesting historical first century question about that. So he's going around the Mediterranean. And so one of the reasons he's writing Romans is to make sure, because if you can have the Roman community in your back pocket and go home and say, look, I got a gift from Rome. They're in the program too. And not only makes the Jerusalem church look good, it makes Paul look good. So all that's going on in this first century too. Another purpose is certainly to just introduce himself. Now, I might have touched upon this a little bit last week, and I am certainly no expert of first century Rome. But, you know, Rome is a thriving city. Rome is the empire. That may be part of the social context about Paul's talking about, you know, not pay attention, but give your allegiance to the secular authorities, all right? Because they tax you, pay your taxes, do all this stuff. That's another interesting thing. We're going to be preaching on that text and studying that text the Sunday after the election. You know? I mean, what do those words tell us, however we come out, whether we're tickled to death or really disturbed by what happened on, election day? What does Scripture tell us about our responsibility to the civic arena? But never forget that Paul was writing in the first century when there was only one empire, not democratically elected by any stretch of the imagination. The emperor was seen as a kind of divine figure. And Rome, look, for all its wonder in terms of the Roman legal system and the Roman roads and the Roman all this and everything, they were a dominating, crushing force. And if you got on their bad side, they'd just soon as let you live. And they did. We have so much evidence in the first century Greco-Roman texts of, you know, even high-standing Roman officials in North Africa getting in trouble and Rome kills them. Rome would think of nothing, and we see it in 66 in Jerusalem. Rome thinks nothing of coming and just wiping people out, but that's what needs to be done. I mean, that is a powerful empire. And it's why, of course, the book of Revelation uses coded language about Babylon and the horror of Babylon. I mean, it's Rome. So Rome's not a nice place to some extent, okay? Part of our understanding of that chapter is also Paul telling his Jewish Christian friends and Gentile friends, hey, you know, you live in a context of imperialism. You know, it's okay to, you know, it's okay to follow that as well as be people of faith. But that chapter is very interesting. Paul writes a letter. This is clearly a letter of introduction. We are told that Paul did not found this church, did not begin this church. There were other people. Which raises a fascinating issue of first century history about who founded that church. How did they do that? We don't know. Christians are out and about. It wasn't Peter. Even though the Roman church, and I'm not trying to trash the Roman Catholic tradition, and we all have our tradition, our stories about how things work, our narrative, but it's pretty certain that Peter did not get to Rome. At least in that point. So he didn't start that church. Paul didn't start that church. You know, we've got evidence of Aquila and Priscilla. Ned Edwards, hi! Good gracious. People, you know Ned Edwards' former pastor? And Barb! Oh, Barb! How are you? Come sit down.
You saved a seat in the front row for you.
Well, I've got to leave in 10 minutes to go to practice with Anna. I'm supposed to get your permission to sing the Kyrie this morning.
Sure.
Thank you.
Welcome, Ned. I'm glad you're here.
Thank you. We're doing
Romans. So, you know.
Doing stay. Romans. Good.
Yeah, we're doing Romans. Or get up and leave when you have to. Where was that? When I feel like Paul has just walked in. A guy who's out in the hinterlands spreading the gospel to Michigan. And we in the home church.
Did he start the church in Rome?
He might have.
In Buell.
Oh, I didn't mean that. I was just trying to tell you where you were.
That was good. Thank you. No, that was helpful. Yeah, in Buell. You know, we know Paul didn't start this church in Rome. So that opens up this interesting question, who did? And so, you know, we don't know. It wasn't Peter. So certainly Paul is writing this letter to the Romans in part to introduce himself to the church in Rome. And your question about the social context of Rome was very interesting. Because in 49, Emperor Claudius, an edict of 49, kicked the Jews out of town and certainly disrupted the Jewish social community, the religious community. I'm going to use the word synagogue, but you know, first century synagogue, it's probably, we can't say that with any precision. But certainly the communities of Jews was disrupted. And so part of the reason I think Paul is writing this is to kind of help integrate Gentile Christians and Jewish Christians. Because when the Jewish Christians come back into Rome, they have this bit of cognitive dissonance. Do we go back into the Jewish sort of, you know, community structure? Or do we go with the Gentile Christian community structure? So there may be a little bit of cognitive dissonance there. And there may be this sense of, well, I think there is, because Paul talks about pride all the time through no reason to boast, don't do this, we're both sinners, you know. But the point is, there may be a point where the Gentile Christians have now perhaps see themselves as the top group. And the Jewish Christians are trying to figure out, where do we fit in here? And it may be one of the reasons why Paul writes with such passion, although I admit it's a little confusing, when you start cracking open, what does Paul really think about the place of, you know, Judaism in God's sort of historical plan. But at the end of the day, you know, he said, you know, we're all in this together. So it may be that Paul is trying to coordinate and integrate these two communities, okay? And then, of course, clearly he wants to lay out his understanding of what God is doing in history in theological terms. Now, I said last week, and I think this is important, I think Paul is much more a historiographer than a theologian. And I think Paul is essentially making these new connections about what his encounter with Jesus Christ means as he's going out into the Mediterranean world. You know, he's making these connections. And I think Rome, he's writing, you know, probably his most thorough kind of statement on that. But I don't think we should be reading Romans as a series of doctrines that he's explaining as much as laying out a history of what God is doing, which gets me down to the prophetic, apocalyptic, and the eschatological. I know you know what those words mean. But the prophetic is... Yeah, sure.
When you said...
Well, certainly I think he's trying to integrate. And yes, to a certain extent, I do think he's saying, listen, you upstart Gentiles, you know, Gentile Christians, you got a tradition and you can't just cut this off. In fact, to a certain extent, I mean, he goes into this law of grace thing. You know, that's unpackable in 15 minutes. But I mean, there is this sense that we don't throw the law out just so you can have this new experience. We certainly don't throw out Judaism. You know, remember, God chose them first. You've been grafted on. And then it gets a little confusing about what we do with the tree that's been lopped off and how, you know. But nevertheless, there is this sense of, remember, you are grounded in a tradition you have continuity with, and don't you forget it. And I think that comes from Paul. As I said last week, I don't think Paul converted. Paul had a deeper sense that his Judaism and his confrontation with Jesus Christ was calling him in to this new way of looking at history. But it had, I think to Paul's mind, continuity with Judaism. You know, what he was preaching now, I think he would say, had continuity from God's action of creation, liberation, restoration, the prophetic witness. Because, I mean, what is prophecy after all? But God saying to a specific time in history, hear me. You know, hear me. I am still active in this history, what you are going through. And the relationship, of course, between, you know, sort of history on this end and the history of God's justice and the history of God's concern for those who are on the fringe. Okay, so this prophetic witness, God speaks in history. God is not some idea way out there. God is active in our history. Apocalyptic, which is a lovely fancy word for revelation. You know, so what Paul is describing is this new kind of revelation, this new way of thinking about prophetic history that is leading to an end time. And as I said last week, don't confuse Paul. Or like, I love Paul. I have my own battles with him, but I really love Paul. Personally, don't confuse Paul with the modern day evangelist end time preachers like we get on TV. In fact, you know, just reading Romans, I mean, Paul has nothing to do with them. They are missing the point of the gospel, Paul would say, in my interpretation. But I mean, I think I'm right about that. But history does move towards something. And we're used to talking about that language. I mean, Dr. King talked about what? The whole arc, you know, the whole arc of history bends towards justice. I mean, Paul, the whole arc of history is bending towards God finally revealing, I think, salvation for all. You know, that the whole point of this madness is that God is recreating and restoring and recalling so that we who are on this earth and groaning for that type of experience of reconciliation, it is ours. It is ours. That is what is promised. We may not feel it at this precise moment, but this is exactly what's happening. Okay? So let me stop there. Any more questions? Any just sort of feedback? What are you thinking about? Yeah,
I'll pipe up. I think that I was thinking this week a little bit about that idea of Paul as a historiographer, and it makes perfect sense. I think you used the term madness. I think he kind of saw a world that seemed crazy, and in a way he was a part of it before his trip to Damascus. And somehow that experience changed him, and he was able, through that framework of looking at God's action in history,
right,
to make sense out of this crazy world he was in.
Right.
And that was, I think, maybe the only way to make sense of that.
Right.
You know, that just piling more theology that, you know, of the ilk that he'd grown up with didn't work.
Right.
It just didn't work. You know, the law thing somehow wasn't sufficient.
Right. Anymore. Good. Yeah, I think that's right. Please.
I was just thinking, I don't think Paul was necessarily systematic in how he was thinking, so it's hard to put a system on top of him.
Thank you.
So.
And when I say theology, that's something that in seminary, I am not a systematic theologian. That's not the way my brain works. So when I think of theology, I think of someone with a really clear system. And you're right, Paul was not that. I mean, the whole structure, it is letter. It is not theological tome, even though lots of themes that would come out. Okay. Any other? Yes, Anne, please.
Well, eschatology, it's a very interesting word. And I think one of the errors that we get into a lot is thinking about eschatology as being the end of time rather than ultimate concerns. And my understanding from reading about context and so forth is that people in agricultural societies rather than industrial societies think of time as being more cyclical than we tend to think. We think of time as being linear, mm-hmm. but agricultural societies tend to think of time as being more cyclical. And so end times doesn't have the same meaning in that context
right.
that it does for us as being the end of a line of time that comes to an end, a finite line. It has more to do with kind of what's at the center of the circle.
Yeah.
What's the ultimate concern?
Well, that sure resonates with me. I love that kind of imagery because I think you're right. I think that we misinterpret, like when Jesus talks about the kingdom of God or you know, is coming near, we think of that in chronological linear time. When I think Jesus is more talking about the fullness of time is right here, and I think Paul has caught up that too. But I think there's a tension there. And I think Paul has a kind, maybe a foot and a little bit of both, that time is moving. But I agree. I think we misinterpret Paul when we set up these constructs of sort of black and white, us and them, law, grace, all these this verses. I think we're missing the Pauline point of a fuller understanding of what God is doing, not just a linear understanding of how God is working. Yeah, I think that's fair. Okay. Wow. Okay, that's all right. We can do this really quick. Just to get, maybe dip your toe in the water. And then, of course, it's up to you, because that's my whole point. It's not what I tell you. It's if I can spark in you an interest to read, that's enough. And so let me just, real briefly. Betty, you are so right. The first couple of chapters are boom. And he gets into it. But what Paul is essentially doing is what Reinhold Niebuhr wrote, that the only verifiable theological doctrine is original sin. Just read your morning papers. Right? Just look at it. We are broken, messed up. No matter what we try to do, we keep getting involved in this, this, and this. Our instinct, we may even want to do this, but we end up doing this. It on a cosmic level, on a historical level, on a personal level. Now, of course, all of you are good people. You are trying to do your best as I do. All that's fine. And you know it and I know it. There are days I wake up and I feel like I'm a total failure. I haven't done the right thing. That's a little bit overstated. But you know what I'm saying? Things aren't working out in my family. You know, Deanne and I aren't talking like we usually do. I come here, I feel overloaded and just like, yuck. What is this all for? So, you know, we're all part of that. Doesn't make us evil. I'm not suggesting that. I'm just saying we're broken. We're off the mark. Right? And we know all the social concerns. We're off the mark. That's how Paul opens his letter. Gentiles, you've got the power, you've got the history, you've got the empire, you've got the language, you've got the drama, you've got the philosophy. Yeah. And also, don't boast. You do a lot of crazy things. And there's a whole list, and I'm going to let you unpack it. Right? Okay, so we're setting up. The end of chapter 1 is like, Gentiles, you don't have the secret. And so you can see, and I love you've said this, Clover, so I'm footnoting you, but there's a sense, and if I goof it up, say it better. But it's sort of like the whole rhetorical movement is just when, you know, the rest of us all, the Gentile, you know, the Christians and the Jewish Christians are going, you know, those Gentile Christians. What does Paul say? Dude, it's you. Don't judge. You got nothing on those people. Nothing. You know? And so the whole rhetorical beginning of this thing is saying, and I think as Christians we would claim, and we can disagree about the precision around what original sin and all that, but the point is, we're broken. We've fallen short of the glory of God. And that's how Paul starts off. But then, what Paul wants to say is, instead of just like, you know, a little like Noah and the flood moment, let's just wipe you all out and start over, what Paul is understanding is, in God's righteousness, the very nature of God. Paul is talking about the very nature of God is not to condemn, not even to punish, but to be on the side of those who are outside of the promise. So God is a God of righteousness for those on the fringe, those left out, those outside the usual way we draw boundaries. That's what Paul's trying to say. And it's because of the grace of Jesus Christ. Now, you, one of the tensions that you will meet and bump up against, and you can argue it both ways. I mean, I read Romans and I see probably the most explicit universalism that we could ever have in the gospel. I understand you can also read Romans another way. And you may be right. I don't know. But I'm just saying, it seems to me that all have fallen short, and then we have this expression of Jesus. The power of Jesus knocking down all the barriers. And now those who were barbarians, and those who were Gentiles, and those who were slaves, those who were women, I mean, however you want to deal the construct, those have now collapsed in on themselves. Right? There is no more, and this is really what I'm preaching on today, there's no more this sense of we have it and you don't. Eric, one of the other issues you're going to bump up against is this nature of law versus grace. Now, if you were raised a Lutheran, or pretty much in any Christian church, the emphasis is sort of, well, you know, the law, we do things to try to please God, and we know we can't. So it leaves us in despair, and therefore we've got to accept the grace of Jesus Christ. Then we're free from the law, we live into grace, and all is well. On a certain level, I understand that. Because I do think the gospel of Jesus Christ frees us from feeling we got to do it all ourselves, we got to figure it out, we got to do right, we goofed up, we might get in trouble with God, we might, you know. Ugh. But Paul's kind of thing is way deeper than that, I think. It's somewhat more simple, but another way more profound. What I think Paul sees, being a Jew, being a good Jew, being shaped by the law, I think it's Paul is critiquing Judaism of the first century. Let's be clear, first century. That at least in the circles that Paul ran around with and confronted in the first century, the Jewish community, and there are good reasons to know why this happened, they were withdrawing more and more, and sort of, what was their defining markers? What were the Jewish defining markers in the first century? Circumcision and the law. Those were the defining boundaries. That's how they said, we're Jews, you're not. That doesn't mean that they thought you were evil and you were going to go to hell, but still the sense of the defining boundary, a social issue. It's a social, political issue of in and out. And Paul in Romans, I think, is saying, law doesn't work as a boundary marker anymore. You know, that's not, it's special, because Paul then goes, look, law, it's not like we're trying to throw away the law. Those things help us figure out who we are and, you know, guide us along a path and all that. But E.P. Sanders, a wonderful American scholar, I think he's still alive, but he was writing in the 70s, 80s, and 90s, you know, talked about that the Jew in the first century, according to him, and he's done this research, and so I'll footnote him, but he felt that the Jew of the first century wasn't all that concerned about pleasing God. They were the chosen people. They didn't have to please God. That, you know, in some sense, that was the problem. Rather, the issue of first century Judaism was a sense of we are apart. And Paul was saying nobody's apart from anybody anymore because of the grace of Jesus Christ. Therefore, circumcision doesn't matter. Therefore, the law, the following of the law doesn't matter. So those are two really, really big things. A third issue you're going to jump into, and I asked you this last week, who's not mentioned? And you know, that's one of those throw out big general questions like, huh? But what I meant by that is that Paul puts, I don't think Moses is ever mentioned. We got once?
Yeah.
What's the context? That's great.
Moses runs a lot.
Yeah, okay. Right. So he is mentioned. So at least Paul recognizes that, you know, but it's really the law. Moses is not the figure that's developed. Who does Paul lift up as like the interpretive key to the whole unfolding of history?
Jesus.
Well, Jesus, of course, but even before Jesus.
Abraham.
Right. And why?
Faith.
Absolutely. So some, but why is Abraham's faith so significant? Why is it even, to Paul, more significant than Moses' faith?
Because he didn't start out as a Jew.
Okay, good. He didn't start out as a Jew. He was a wandering Aramaean. He was, you could argue, a Gentile to some extent. Okay, what else? Peter, I mean...
Well, he had faith before he was circumcised.
Boom! Huge! Strike, yeah, you just pitched the perfect game. That's right. It was before Judaism began, before the defining moment of the Exodus, before the defining circumcision rite on males, before the giving of the law on Mount Sinai to Moses. Now, Paul, I don't think, is trying to be... You know, again, Paul's not trying to overthrow historic Judaism. But he's also trying to suggest, and you can just see, and this is why I love Paul, and I really think he's a genius. Because not only on the one hand is he's going around trying to figure out, like, okay, I've had this confrontation with the risen Lord, what does that mean? You know, in turn, but he's also thinking, my gosh, I'm a Jew, so what does that mean? And I think when Abraham was like, holy cow, I think that was the interpretive key for Paul, Abraham. This is how Jews and Christians hang out together. It's just obvious. Because Abraham, and remember, what's the promise of Abraham? From God to Abraham in Genesis. Yes, generation after generation after generation, through you, many nations will be blessed. Many nations. Right? Many nations will be blessed. So Abraham becomes this interpretive key, and you'll see that again and again. And again, okay. Yeah. In Jesus Christ, the boundaries are broken down so nobody has reason to boast. And this is what I think is such a great critique when I read Romans on so many Christians today. And so much of what I would call, because I don't want to be disrespectful. I really don't. A language is limiting because you end up saying... I was about to use us versus them language, which Paul says, John, but somehow descriptively, I do think that they're sisters and brothers in Christ who tend to use language now of, we've got it, and you don't. And unless you do this, or unless you use this language, or unless you have this experience, you don't really count. I mean, that's the message I receive from Christian, like my cousins, although they love me, and I think they finally feel I'm in the kingdom. I do. But those of you who have Christian, cousins and friends who are just, differently, their theology is a little bit different. That's still what we come across as is, we have it, you don't. And of course, that's what the Muslim Brotherhood or the Islamic feel. We've got it, you don't. That's what the conservative Jewish sects feel. We've got it, you don't. That's what the atheists feel. We've got it, you don't. I mean, it's all this stuff. We got it, you don't. We've got the real truth, you don't. Just dig a little deeper. And I think Paul is sort of, what does it feel like if nobody has it and everybody has it? In some ways, I think that's what Paul is coming to understand in his first century context. And so I think that's part of the reason his language gets a little bit convoluted when he's trying to figure out, so how does this really work, the relationship to the Jews, to the Gentiles, and law and grace? But I think that's where he finally gets to. Okay, so you've got the opening, all of sin and fallen short of the glory of God. Then you have this historical construct. God is doing things in history, and now all through God's righteousness, the outsider is now the insider. People, that is a social political statement. Theological, because where are we keeping the outsiders, outsiders? Good. I like that heavy silence. Think about that. Okay. So he writes this whole letter laying this out, and we get to the final three chapters. And then he talks about, and I love this about Paul. It reminds me of my mother. when I used to give her my sermons early when I was young, you know, I said, how does this even make sense? She goes, well, it's not bad, but so what? So it's a nice idea. What are you telling me to do? And I don't always, I'm going to have a lot of mothers. So what? I can hear you saying that.
You'd
be like, so I know. I'm going to do it. That is the best question to ask any preacher. And if you don't get a so what from me today, hold my rear to the fire. Because I think that's the only thing that Clover and I, at the end of the day, are trying to equip you. There's the so what in all this, right? So anyway, so I love it that Paul gets to the so what. If this is true and all the barriers are broken down, how then do you live? And if you read the last chapters, what you find is, please don't judge. Be there for each other. Show hospitality. You know, then there's that chapter about, yeah, you could be citizens in a real world. I mean, I think that's the thrust of that chapter. You know, you can be real citizens. It doesn't take you out of the world. It engages you with the world. You know, be there for the weaker sister or brother. Now, that opens up a lot of, you know, but the ethic there is right. It's not about you. It's not about what you have to do. It's about what God has done. This isn't about you getting your own way. It's about you being like, well, being like God. I mean, that sounds bad, but you know what I mean? If God's model is to break barriers down, that's how you should be living. So be gentle with your sister or your brother, you know, and be there together in community. And then he closes and says, I love y'all, greet all my buds, my friends, and he gives a whole long list, and if Ann were sitting there, I'm talking to a chair. This is in a hot room. I love Clint Eastwood. He's giving me something to get there. So, Ann, what I want to tell you is that's another interesting social social clues, the names that he offers. And it's women and men. It looks like high status, low status. Certainly Romans, some Greeks. They're Jews. He says, greet Mary. I mean, Mary is about a Jewish name as you can get. I mean, not the way you use it now, but Maria. Mariam. I mean, that's the Jewish name. So they're Jews, they're Gentiles, they're Romans, they're Greeks, they're women, they're men. He identifies, I said, as women as leaders of the church. He puts Prisca's name before Aquila. So there's a whole lot of social clues going on that Paul gets his own stuff. Barriers broken down? Let's be in all this together. So I'm going to quit there. Any questions? And then let's go up. I'm getting chill. I still got to preach. I just used all my energy right here. Now I've got to do this again. What am I going to do? Clover, you better help me when I fail. Anyway, okay. Any questions? Your reaction to that? How are you feeling after these 2 weeks of watching me get all excited? Are you ready for this Bible?
Yes.
Really? Are you ready for Romans?
Yes.
What? Thank you, Clyde. Clyde said, more eager to read and study Paul. Amen. Engage with it. And I really want you, because there's a tendency for, and I'm going to use labels again. Paul, forgive me. You forgive me. But I think those of us who are a little bit more progressive and you know, really want to lay out a biblical vision for inclusiveness on all levels, we can't help but read Paul through those verses of like 118, and he seems like he's anti-homosexual. And we read other verses, oh, he must be anti-women, and he must be these. Well, okay, they're there, but the challenge is, do you read those little verses? Do you give them more power than they need? I'm just asking. Do you interpret shorter verses by larger vision, or do you interpret the largest vision by these little things that are like 5 or 6 verses? All the scripture, that's all it says. And we're taking the entire majesty of the gospel of Jesus Christ and filtering it through 4 or 5 little verses that seem limiting, that might not even come from Paul, and might not even be in the proper context. We might not even be understanding it right. Come on. So get engaged, open your mind, ask your questions, wrestle with it. And I'll even say one more radical thing, because this gets into a deeper theological issue, it seems to me, about what we think of the authority of Scripture. I think that's worthy. I mean, I have a very high theology of the living word and authority of Scripture. Well, what that means to me is, boy, we get to wrestle with it big time, because our Christian community for 2,000 years has seen in these words the identity of our community. That's why we study this, people. It's not dead word. It's not dead word like they really believe that. Well, that doesn't describe me. It's like, engage with your forebears. This is our narrative, so we've got to wrestle with it. We've got to learn it, and I think we've got to love it. But even if Paul was anti-homosexual, who died and made him God? He wouldn't want that. You know, even if, I think the living word allows us to engage.
And he said, do not judge.
Thank you. Well, that's going to be the final. Don't judge me for that last comment. Don't judge one another. Let's go up and get a so what moment at church today. Amen. Get out of here.